Welcome to Series 2 of the My Swim podcast. And what better way to start the new series than to catch up with one of the founders of the magazine that the UK open water swimming community refer to as the Open Water Magazine. This podcast caters for all kinds of aquatic adventures, but today we concentrate on the outdoor swimming kind. We meet Simon Griffith of the Outdoor Swimming Magazine and cover some fascinating insights, not only into the world of a premier magazine, but also into Simon's unique close-up knowledge of how open water swimming has evolved over recent years, along with some great advice on how to get the most out of your outdoor swim. This is the first half of a two-part podcast. The second part has been uploaded and you can download it from wherever you normally get your podcasts. As the waters in the Northern Hemisphere start to warm up and those who have been winter swimming start to be joined by those enjoying the warmer spring waters, we hope this is the perfect time to tap into Simon's knowledge and arm more people with the confidence to try or expand their limits. Welcome to the My Swim podcast. Simon, welcome to the My Swim podcast and thank you for coming in to talk to us about the Open Water Magazine.
Thank you.
It is recognised as that, so it's been good to... And prior to this, we were talking through... We were meant to be doing this in the lovely surroundings of Montenegro on a beach with a nice refreshment in hand, but it got so busy, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a fantastic event, but I think I saw you when we arrived. Yeah. I think I saw you passing it a couple of times. We never got that chance to sit down and even grab a coffee, unfortunately.
That's right.
That we can catch up now.
Okay, well, look, I hear... Through the grapevine, it was your birthday on Tuesday.
That would be Facebook letting me down. Facebook's done me in again.
Every bit of social media going. Well, on behalf of the My Swim podcast, happy birthday. For those on the audio and not being able to watch your own thing, there's an extensive birthday cake coming out. Well, it's a cupcake with a candle in it. So, look, as long as you don't make me sing your happy birthday... On behalf of the My Swim podcast, happy birthday, was it 21?
Something like that.
Yeah, something close to that. plenty of swimming years left in you, yeah, as we go.
Oh, that is amazing. Thank you so much. I can't believe you've done that.
Something to have for your coffee, what's left of it.
That is really great. Thank you.
Okay, mate. Okay, so you better blow them up. They're going to... Still got the lungs for it.
Yeah.
Okay. If we can take you, before we get into about the magazine, if we take you back into, you know, what brought you into open water swimming and then the progression and the journey then to take that on to say, do you know what? There's a magazine here that people will be interested in.
Okay. It's a long story, obviously, as these things are. Swimming related, but I'll try and keep it concise. Swam as a kid, Cheltenham Swimming and Water Polo Club, so quite a good club back in probably still is, actually haven't been back for a long time. Swam there and stopped when I was about 13, just, you know, as people move on, started doing a lot of kayaking at the time as well. So, then went to university, joined the swimming club at university, swam there. A couple of years after that, I discovered triathlon, and that was really, although I that was really my first open water swimming, where I was getting in a wetsuit and racing in open water. I'd obviously been in the sea a lot, and you know, when we were growing up, my mum used to take us to the beach, or she used to take us to I was in the Cotswold Lakes, you know, that probably Lake 32 or one of those. We didn't call it that then. I don't know what it was. It was still just the gravel pits we used to go. She used to take us there, and we used to swim there. So triathlon was my introduction to racing in open water.
Right.
Then, I mean, that was you know, that's still a long time ago. And then I went off and did other things.
That would be fairly new sport.
Yeah, it was like late 1980s.
Saltgrass, yeah. Yeah,
So triathlon was quite an exciting place to be then. And you know, I was always a better swimmer than I am a runner or a cyclist. So it was quite nice to do an event where you're starting with, you know, near the front, you get overtaken.
Yeah, that's the whole bit.
Then, you know, family, kids, job. And so I found myself basically staying at home looking after the kids at about 15, 20 years ago. I was doing some kind of freelance projects of various types. One of them I was writing for Triathlon magazine,
right?
Triathletes World, which doesn't exist in print anymore. I was writing mostly about swimming. I started doing a lot of the swimming events there. It was that time where triathlon organisers were allowing people to do swim-only events. And then, you know, Henley Swim had started. It was just after 2008 when we'd had the first marathon swim. Great Swim, I think, started around the same time. Mm-hmm. So standalone swimming events were coming. Marathon swimming had become something in the Olympics. So people were talking about open water swimming as a, you know, as you know, not something that you just do at the end of your career when you kind of, you know, it's something that people really started training for and aspiring to. The Outdoor Swimming Society had been launched in 2006, and that was growing. So it was on my mind, it was on people's minds. So I've been working with another magazine, so I thought, I mean, I didn't know enough not to do it. That was the thing.
So most people get into it, isn't it?
Didn't know enough not to start a magazine. So I Google searched, how do you run a magazine?
Right.
Basically outsourced almost everything, so, you know, the printing, the postage, the subscriptions management. There's a lot of services you can get to run the magazine. So then I could focus on gathering the content. Had to obviously recruit a designer as well. I used a freelance designer. So you can outsource all the bits and pieces. It becomes a management thing rather than a creative. So yeah, I'm just concentrated on getting the content in. I focused on that.
So
that was 2011.
Okay. Oh, when did it launch?
That's 2011. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. So it's been going a long time then.
Yeah, 12 years now.
So what sort of criteria do you use to select a story or bring a something to the community?
That's a slightly loaded question because I'm no longer the editor. We've got Ella Foote. She came in as the editor and she's absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. Really, really like what she does. So she will select and design the content now.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like, similar lines, but targeting perhaps a slightly different audience to what I was doing initially. But I was like, is this something I'm interested in? Is this something that is going to help me in my swimming? Is this something that's going to help someone else in their swimming?
Yeah.
Is it fun to read? Is it a nice story? So it's really about, you know, appealing to, you know, what's going to appeal to swimmers, what's going to make them think, oh yeah, I need to read that, I need to know that, this is going to make my enjoyment of swimming better, this is going to help me swim a bit faster, this is going to help me swim a bit further, this is going to keep me safer, whatever it is. How is it going to make a difference to you?
So that's interesting, because you can not glamorize, that's not the right word, but you can showcase all the great things of swimming. People want to come to it, but you've got to balance that with the safety side of it, making sure people understand what they're taking on.
Yeah.
Do you have a great emphasis to make sure that people understand the risks of those? And any tips for anyone who might have anxiety of just getting into the open water?
Yeah. This is a really interesting area, and it's a really... it's quite a tightrope to walk, because there's a lot of fears around open water swimming. And you know, you probably grew up in the 70s and 80s. You probably saw the public service announcements on television. It's like, you know, if you go near this reservoir, you're going to drown immediately. So I think there's a, there's a legacy of fear of open water in our culture.
Yeah.
And that is perhaps overblown. I think it definitely is overblown. And it's not that as soon as you step into a lake, you're going to drown.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there is always a risk that you might. And obviously the consequences are very severe. It's not like, you know, if you go for a run and you fall over and you graze your knee, you know, you patch it up and you're fine again 2 days. Like, the consequences can be very severe. So the probably the risk of something bad happening is quite low, but the consequences are very severe. And as people, we're not that good at sort of ranking risks. And
no.
So there is a lot of fear about outdoor swimming that's out there. And so on the one hand, you want to reassure people and encourage them. But at the same time, there are real dangers. That the risks are low, but the consequences are really severe. So it's really important that people are aware of what those risks are and how to manage those. And as people are experimenting with different things in swimming, and we see more and more people wanting to swim longer distances, swimming colder water, doing more extreme events, those risks are landing on a broader and broader range of people with a wide range of experiences. So I think it is really important to keep reminding people of what those risks are, but not in a fear-mongering way.
Yeah.
These are risks, and this is how you manage them. Not these are risks, don't do it.
Yeah.
This is how you can manage them, and you can have a very safe swim.
Yeah, we always work on the basis, if you know how you're going to get out, mm-hmm. as well. Water temperature, is it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, within your range, you haven't got no specifics, but swim with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Those basics are one. I mean, that you can add to that, I suppose, pool boys and things like that. But to me, if you go to a recognised place, like we both go to Shepparton Lake, but there mm-hmm. are many now opening up or have opened up, then a lot of that work's done for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can just enjoy swimming in the open water with the sun on your back, if you're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you say the work's done for you, and I think that's a very good reason to use the commercial venue where there's a lifeguard, and you know the water quality has been tested, there's other people around you, there's mm-hmm. safety kayakers on the water, but it's still open water.
It is, yeah.
It is still open water. So you know, if you're not feeling well, or if you're
mm-hmm.
you know, if you're struggling a little bit when you're out on the water, just get out.
Yeah.
You know, it's
there's always another day. Yeah, that's good. So are there health benefits that you cover quite regularly within the obviously the fitness side of it? Maybe an obvious one, but there's so much more to it than
so it's interesting. And I think, you know, possibly a lot of people come into swimming, especially when we're younger, that our aim is fitness, and we take our health for granted. A lot of us do anyway. I mean, I know that was, you know, I'm fit, so therefore I'm healthy. And I think that's when you're young, you kind of get away with that, and it's very much about fitness and performance, and you want to do well at things. And I think as you get older, you start to appreciate that there are, it's not just the health benefit, it's not just a fitness benefit, it's a health benefit, and in fact they're separate. And if you don't look after your health, you can't have the fitness. The health is actually, your health is more important than your fitness, and you've got to have that first before you can put fitness on top.
That's
really
interesting. Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, as the more you swim, you discover that it actually is supporting your health in many ways. I mean, it's just and movement is good for your health, separate to fitness. Doing movement for health rather than fitness, just doing something and then being with other people, that's good for your health.
Mm-hmm.
I know you give me cakes here, but you know, if you're physically active, yeah. I think it encourages you and to think about what you eat.
Yes.
Yeah. So of course we can, you know, you can indulge and enjoy some cake, but you know, 80% of the time you're probably eating quite healthy, yeah. because yeah. you know you because you want to keep doing what you're doing, and you know that to do that you have to stay healthy. I think regular exercise, not training, but just activity, helps you sleep better, helps in your relationships, helps you connect with people. And then there's all the anecdotal evidence about the cold water immersion. I'm not talking about the extreme stuff, but you know, even in the summer, it's yes. cool, you know, relatively cool getting into open water. There's a lot of anecdotal stuff about how it supports your mental health and mental well-being. And you know, and I'm in the fortunate position that I've never suffered a sort of mental health illness. But is that perhaps because I've always been doing something that supports good mental health?
And you've looked at it holistically. I quite like that holistic approach. When you talk about health there, you weren't determining between physical and mental. They are the package. The
two, yeah.
you know, which is good. That's a really good way of looking at it. I quite like that. Because I think the mental health benefits come up time and time again through discussions on this podcast. And it's a lot of strength in that. And I think there's many, many parts to it. There's the community part as well as the regular exercise, yeah. which supports all of that, which is good. And as you say, then if that's set, you've got a platform to build on to whatever challenges you want to take on, which is good. How do you incorporate the environmental awareness into the magazine? Do you cover that? So, because I won't lead you, but there's certain parts of it that are in the news.
So there's a few things. One, as a business, what's our impact on the in the environment? And this is always quite an interesting one as well, because we sometimes have people say, "Oh no, I don't want a paper magazine because it's bad for the environment. Mm-hmm. I'll get a digital version instead." But actually, it's more subtle than that, because with paper, we use paper from sustainable sources, we use carbon balanced paper.
Well, excellent.
So all the paper we use doesn't have any. It's neutral in terms of mm-hmm. carbon emissions. We use recyclable paper envelopes. We don't use plastic on the wraps. The printer we use has a zero waste policy, zero to landfill. And they use vegetable based inks. So a magazine is actually
really gone through that.
The magazine itself is a, you know, it's a relatively sustainable product, and it can be recycled when you're done with it.
Yeah.
And you can keep it. You know, I'd obviously rather everyone bought their own subscription, but you can share it with your friends. So it can be, you know, it can be read multiple times, and you can keep it and read it, or you can recycle it when you're done with it. So the magazine itself is not, it's not a particularly environmentally damaging product.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously a little bit with the postage. If you're reading, when you read about everything that's stored in the cloud, you think, well, actually, there's a lot of energy that goes into storing that. So it's not quite that the paper's bad, digital is good. You know, I think paper still has its merits. And, you know, a lot of people still prefer reading in paper anyway.
I'll be honest, because you went entirely digital during
lockdown. We did during lockdown, COVID.
Obviously, my... when you look for someone to buy something for Christmas, the kids have got no idea. So my wife always gives me a subscription, so I go from that. And so that's they'll get each year. And I remember during the COVID, it was online, which it worked. It was good. Yeah. It was good. It was going through. But to me, there's something about having that coming in, sitting down, and you go, right.
Yeah,
leave me alone.
Okay. Well, we saw subscriptions started tailing off when we went to Stony, and then they came back when we went to print. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
So there's still a good cohort of people that like to read in print.
I suppose it's that balance, isn't it? Because as I say, I love the magazine, and I love the sort of the feel of it, sitting down and reading it. But to be able to get that wider afield, because you're UK based, to get that wider afield, it must get far more difficult to be posted, or do you have like a local printer?
No, we're not big enough for that. There's not a big enough audience in the US. So, there might be, but we haven't reached them.
One of our biggest audiences in the US.
Okay. So if we ship to the US, we do ship to the US, and we've got about 100 subscribers in Princeton in the US.
Mm-hmm.
The cost of postage is more than the cost of the magazine. So it's double to subscribe in the US. And it's not coming to us, that goes to the Royal Mail.
Yeah.
So I think a digital subscription, if you want the content and you don't mind reading digital, and we've got a couple of different digital reading options. So the content's easy to get digitally if you want it.
Well, you give us those details, I'll put them in the show notes, because as I say, we I don't know, I think we're up to something like 60 of different countries that this is recorded coming out to. So
all the content is available digitally anywhere in the world.
Brilliant. Okay.
So that was the paper versus thing. So sticking to on the question. So another thing we do is we work with and this is again on the business side, and we'll come and talk about the shit and rivers afterwards, because I know that's what you really want to talk about.
Yeah. Well, no, I wouldn't lead you.
So we work with another business called Climate Games, and they have an app, and through that app we create challenges for swimmers, and they're simple things. It's like swim 15k in a month. Mm-hmm. And actually, even if you don't complete the channel, you still have the environmental benefit. And what Climate Games do is, if you enter the challenge, one of the challenges we set up, they will then go and remove plastic from the ocean, or they work with an NGO or a mm-hmm. not-for-profit that's removing plastic from the ocean somewhere else in the world. So that's just something anyone can, you don't even need to be a subscriber, you can sign up to our challenges on Climate Games. You log your swims in the app, and then at the end of the month you will, you know, it might be 100 grams, 200 grams, you know, it's not much per person, but if, you know, if 100 people do it, it starts adding up.
What about a swimming club? Could a master swimming club
join in? They could all do it.
Yeah.
They could, yeah.
Okay, that's something.
Yeah, it's really easy. So I can show you that.
We'll put it in the show notes. Definitely, that's something that we'll look at for us.
So that's, you know, as a business, that's what we try to do. And then obviously, and this is something that's, you know, and I know you didn't want to lead me this way, but obviously, you know, this is what everyone's been talking about the past 2 years, really, is how much untreated sewage is ending up in our rivers, and how much pollution is in our rivers or in the sea, but the rivers get into the sea, or sometimes it goes directly into the sea. And again, the situation probably isn't that much worse to 5 years ago. The awareness of the problem has gone through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is a really good thing, and it's become a political issue. It's going to be part of the general election, I'm pretty sure. People are campaigning, people are protesting, and the evidence against the water companies looks pretty compelling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I haven't got the original evidence, so it's sort of hearsay evidence from what other campaigners are saying, but that a lot of the sewage spills have not been within their consents, so they've been illegal. So they have illegally spilled untreated sewage into the environment, which is obviously bad for the environment. It's bad for fish, it's bad for insects, bad for plant life in the water. And if you swim in it, it can be bad for you. Now, obviously, really great that there's increasing pressure on the water companies and signs that they are responding to consumer reaction and consumer pressure and political pressure to do something. The downside is the publicity around it has put people off swimming.
And
we've seen that. We've had people emailing and saying, you know what, I'm not swimming anymore because of pollution. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily that they've had a bad incident themselves, but they've seen
there's enough in the press.
You know, and what the press does, as we know it does in all sorts of domains, is they will publish a story about the one person that got ill and not the 15,000 people that swam without any trouble. And so we find ourselves quite torn here, because, you know, we want, as swimmers and as, you know, as good citizens, we want to live in a nice environment, we want a cleaner environment, we want cleaner rivers. So we want to amplify that voice through our platforms, and we have, you know, we have the platforms in the audience to do that and spread that messaging. but we don't want to put people off swimming because that's our business and we need people to swim, because if they don't swim, they don't buy magazines or they don't go to races and they don't buy products from our advertisers. So it's this kind of double-edged thing for us.
Attention, yeah.
You know, if people stop swimming, we don't have a business. And, you know, potentially that's a load of voices lost in the campaign to clean up rivers. So I think there's also some sort of proportionality there. I mean, I swim in the Thames, which has a terrible reputation. I swim there two or three times a week all year round.
Okay.
I monitor when the sewage, when the CSOs are discharging, and I avoid swimming directly after that. But a lot of the time, it's actually the water quality is good,
yeah.
And you can swim without problems. And you know, we've got a lot of people that have swum without problems throughout the summer and into the winter as well. But what you'll always hear is, "Oh, but I've got a mate who got really sick," and it's, you know, but it's actually really hard to. You know, it might have been coincidental with swimming in the river. It might not have been caused by the river.
No.
But we don't know that.
No,
so, you know, it's one of those risk management things, but it's it's like with cold water, you can feel the risk. It's very, it's a manifest where you can see immediately and feel immediately, okay, there's something happening here.
Mm-hmm.
With sewage, it's a bit hidden.
Mm.
So you don't know what you don't know when it's going to get you.
So, and even more so with the runoff of from fields from agriculture into more rural areas as well. So, but then we get algae bloom, which is a natural forming through environmental. But there's stuff there. But I think your point was really well made in that you've got to balance that. You know, you're going into an environment that can give you so much. That you've got to balance that, okay, there is always a little risk, as there would be, as you say, if you go to a restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, who knows whether that's all been perfectly done, but you take that risk, don't you?
Because
you weigh it up and you go, do you know what, I'm looking forward to this and I'm doing it. And I think the swimming is the same for me. I couldn't not do it. If there was something very obvious in there, then, today there's another day, the same way as
you can do that. And you know, and I think you also, you know, like if you're about to go on holiday and you're going to be on an 8-hour flight, you say, okay, maybe today I don't do that swim first thing in the morning, just in case, because you know. But if you've got a day where you're working at home and okay, if you've got a little bit of an upset tummy, it's not so it's absolute risk, and it's the risk in your circumstances as well.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I think that's very balanced. So, about inclusivity and diversity in the magazine, I often notice that's you're quite strong on that. What I've read over the recent years, particularly.
You know, everybody should swim. Everybody should have. The way I feel is, I get so much out of swimming. Why should anyone be excluded from that opportunity?
Absolutely.
I think that people don't purposely exclude other people.
No.
I don't think there may be a little bit of maliciousness, but mostly it's not. Mostly it's just they haven't even thought about it. Mm. And they haven't even thought about what are the barriers for other people. And they said, well, you know, anyone would be welcome to come and swim with us. And they would be, but they haven't really tried to understand what the barriers are that might be stopping people coming and swimming with them. If we can show, highlight what some of those barriers are and where people who struggle with those barriers can find places to where they feel safe to swim, then we're going to help more people to swim. And I think even raising awareness within the swimming community that what you find, you know, you probably find it really easy to go to the lakeside, strip off under a towel, put your costume on, get in the lake and start swimming. For some people, there's a huge cultural barrier around that. So they need, you know, single sex sessions where they feel safe to swim. They need costumes that cover their body more fully than the stuff that most of us wear. And you need to, you know, if there are never pictures of that, so for example, you could say, well, you know, they could wear a full body costume, but if If the rest of us haven't seen pictures of people doing that, it's going to start inviting comment. But if you kind of normalize that by publishing stories about it, having pictures of, then someone turns up in a full body costume. There's no comment anymore. It's just the same thing with
most sports, isn't it? Yeah. Having the role models or something.
And trying to create those safe spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also that there's hidden things that you don't realise until people tell you that they, you know, I've had people say to me, "Oh, well, I'd never go to a venue that I didn't know on my own. I couldn't do it. I'd be, you know, people might be unkind to me." So that there's people have these anxieties and fears, I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't know where to change. I wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
So the more we can show through pictures and through stories about where it's accessible, about how spaces are trying to make themselves welcoming to people, we can try and help reduce some of those anxieties. Well, I don't think we can solve it, but if we can help and contribute to that and make swimming more accessible to more people, then, you know, I think that's something we should do.
Mm-hmm. So what impact are you hoping you're going to be able to give on the perceptions and popularity of open water swimming through the magazine?
So quite often, obviously, with the magazine, we are preaching to the converted. We are people who buy the magazine tend to already be fans of outdoor swimming, and they've already implicitly, intrinsically understand that getting into the water is going to make them feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I'd really love to do, and I don't know how to do this. I mean, I guess, you know, I guess we've got the magazine, which is our sort of loyalist channel,
mm-hmm.
but through our social media, through talking to the press, what I'd love to be able to do is spread that message wider. And there are so many people that, you know, maybe it links a bit to the previous point, that for something for you and me is really easy, is, you know, go to a swimming pool. I mean, if you move to a different part of the country,
mm-hmm.
you could find a master's club and join up and go swimming. You'd find a lake and go swimming. You'd go on the local Facebook group and find people to swim with. That's really easy for you. And then you're confident when you get there, you're confident in your swimming ability, that you'd be able to deal with the situation. And a lot of people don't have that. They haven't swum as kids. They haven't been in this environment that It's overwhelming. You know, you've got to go somewhere. You've got to take off your clothes. You've got to do something you know, with people who have been doing this for a long time, who you may perceive are at a different level to you in that mm-hmm. activity. You know, and I think one of the really nice things about outdoor swimming is it is that leveler in a way, if we're racing, there's huge differences in speed. But if you're getting in the river in winter, and a lot of the time, we swim with people, we end up doing head-up breaststroke because it's, mm-hmm. one, because the water's a bit... but two, because it's really cold. You don't want to put your face in.
Yeah, yeah.
And three, because often, you know, the it's really scenic in the winter. The sun's going to be coming up, mist on the water. So why don't I put my head in the water now? So, yeah, and then when you swim head-up breaststroke, everyone swims the same speed, pretty much.
Yeah.
So you've instantly got an activity.
You're talking most of the time as well.
You're talking and chatting. Yeah. You've instantly got an activity that's very equalising, mm-hmm. and and levelling. And if only you can overcome those barriers about getting changed in public, getting into water that looks maybe a little bit suspect, is really cold.
Yeah.
And especially if you're not used to it. You know, even like 15 degree water feels really cold if you're not used to it. You know, so there are plenty of people, I could never swim in the river, I could never get, you know, people that live on my street live right next to the river, no, I couldn't do what you do. And it's right there in front of them. And so there's a huge... too cold, it's not for me. And the barriers seem bigger, when you're looking at it from the outside, the barriers to swimming seem bigger than they are to us, those of us who do it, and the benefits seem smaller. The people that read the magazine know that the barriers, although they look bigger, are not as big as they seem, mm-hmm. and the benefits are bigger than they seem. And so the balance is positive in terms of benefits. And it's trying to explain that to people who just haven't experienced it.
A greater weighting to the
to the barriers. And haven't experienced the benefits. And it's...
That must be really... Yeah.
And it's not going to be for everybody, you know, and people will get similar benefits. And, you know, I mean, I'm biased and I think swimming is a bit unique and something about being in the water is really special.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think if you join a running club or if you join a cycling club or my son does boxing and... What, you know, whatever you do, if you're going to do something that's good for you, I'm biased towards swimming. I think it's particularly special. I think there may be some unique benefits to swimming. Yeah. I've been in running clubs before. I've been on group bike rides. I don't think there's anything quite like swimming, but mm-hmm. I am biased.
Yeah. I think. Well, look, I'm not going to disagree with you, but I think you're right. I think there is something unique and.
This was the first half of a two-part podcast, and I hope you will want to explore further the exciting information Simon will share and download part two wherever you get your podcasts. If you've enjoyed this interview, please leave us 5 stars and please visit our website www.myswim.uk to see some of the artwork that accompanies each of these podcasts, and check out some of our other podcasts too. And until next time, thank you for listening. To capture the joy of each individual My Swim, we have an exclusive bright, fun My Swim podcast themed artwork design. If you enjoy the podcast and the guests, we'd appreciate your support to keep these podcasts going, to help spread the knowledge to a wider community. And please check out the designs on www.myswim.uk. Let us know what you want to hear about, and together, let's build the community. We really want to positively celebrate and promote all aspects of aquatics, and particularly the mental health benefits that swimming can bring, and we'd love you to be a part of it. Join the community, give us your feedback, follow, and tell us all about your individual My Swim.